Next on Radio EcoShock, we're going to catch the wave of startling and disturbing science news coming out of the last couple of weeks. The signs are everywhere. We have passed the climate tipping point. The melting permafrost, hotspots seen by satellite. Scientists and governments are wildly underestimating our current situation. A lot of that is captured by a new multimedia climate show called The Climate Show. What else? The radio show comes out of New Zealand, originating at Kiwi FM in Auckland. There are three great hosts. Glenn Williams runs a New Zealand breakfast show, Radio Whammo. Glenn is a techie who hooks up radio, television, and the internet. The Climate Show is available on YouTube as well. A second regular host is John Cook, blogger extraordinaire at Skeptical Science. Our sample is from Climate Show number 8, where the guest is another New Zealand-born scientist, Dr. Kevin Trenberth, head of the Climate Analysis Section at the USA National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado. In the program, Trenberth, who was one of the targets of the infamous ClimateGate attacks and a lead IPCC author, describes the increased precipitation, floods, and even snowstorms developing in this heating world. A prestigious guest. Dr. Trenberth happened to be in Christchurch, New Zealand, on the very day of that big earthquake there. He was shaken up but unhurt. In today's Radio EcoShock program, we're going to hear a summary of bloody depressing science, as it said, from the third host, another Kiwi, author and super researcher Gareth Renowden. He's the author of Hot Topic, Global Warming and the Future of New Zealand, and blogs at hot-topic.co.nz.
Hello and welcome along to The Climate Show. It's episode number 8. Nice to have you along. My name is Glenn Williams, broadcasting from the Kiwi FM studios in Auckland City. My co-host cannot be possible without him. Of course, it's Gareth Renowden in North Canterbury in Waipara. Hello to you, Gareth.
Hi, Glenn. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I tell you what, I'm not as shaken as you guys have been in the past week.
I wanted to move on to this week's great graphic. It's from NASA's Earth Observatory, and it was the image of the day there a few days ago, February the 24th. And what it shows is the northern hemisphere of our planet, and it's material generated from satellites, and what they've looked at is how the effects of melting snow and ice have acted to warm the northern hemisphere. So, okay, when you've got snow covering the land, what it does is it tends to reflect sunlight. It's called the albedo effect. And so having snow and ice on the ground and on the sea has a cooling effect on the whole of the northern hemisphere. What they've done is they've looked at the change in that over a period of years, over the last 30 years that the satellites have been flying. And so on the left-hand side, the blue picture shows you the cooling effect of snow and ice on the ground. And then the one on the right shows you how that has changed over the last 30 years, 1979 to 2008.
Right.
And so the areas of red there are where reductions in snow and ice cover have acted to warm those areas. And it's quite marked around the Arctic Ocean, parts of the mountainous states in the US, but particularly down there over what are the Himalaya and Tibet. So you can see it's a warming effect. It's quite dramatic. And interestingly, it's much more than the models were predicting. So there's a sign of a, if you like, it's a positive feedback that the general warming has acted to reduce the snow and ice cover, but the reduction in the snow and ice cover is feeding back into the process and increasing the warming.
And this brings us on to the next bit of news about permafrost, and the thawing of permafrost is likely to accelerate global warming.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that science has been aware of for some time. There is a very great deal of carbon locked up in the permafrost left behind by the...
Can you explain exactly what permafrost is?
Okay, well, permafrost is basically frozen ground. The soil contains moisture. Its temperature is below freezing, so it's ice and it's a mixture of ice and soil. And an awful lot of this was created during the last ice age. And mixed up in all of that soil and ice are roots and vegetation, and you know what was the ecosystem before the last ice age is down there under the soil. Now, as long as it stays cold, it's like a refrigerator. This stuff is effectively deep frozen in the ground. But as the permafrost melts, so the ice melts, the vegetation becomes exposed to the atmosphere and to bacteria and bugs that can get in there and start to decompose. So it becomes a food source for this microbial ecosystem. And this gives off the greenhouse gas methane. So the carbon that's locked up in these old frozen soils as they melt can get into the atmosphere. And there is a lot of it there. Now, this latest study calculates that up to two-thirds of the permafrost in the Earth, around the planet, most of which is in the Northern Hemisphere, in kind of Northern Canada and Russia and Siberia, up to two-thirds could disappear over the next 200 years. And that most of this will actually happen over the next 100 years. And the amount of carbon that that will release is equivalent to half of the amount of carbon that we have managed to put into the atmosphere since the start of the Industrial Revolution. Before we started fiddling with the atmosphere, there was about 280 parts per million of CO2. We're now at 390. So you're talking about 110 parts per million. So what they're saying is effectively there's the equivalent of another 55 or so parts per million of CO2 that will come out if this permafrost continues to melt.
The pessimist in me says that's game over, right?
Yeah, well, you've got to hope not. At the very least, it makes the job that we have to do in reducing emissions much, much harder because, you know, we've got to try and stabilize the atmosphere either at current levels, something above current levels, or something below current levels. So effectively, the stuff that comes out of the permafrost makes it harder because we've got to take that into account as well. So if, let's say we were going to aim, as Jim Hansen wants us to do, for a target of 350 parts per million, that means, first of all, that we have to stop emitting carbon and we have to start sucking it out of the atmosphere. But if the permafrost is melting and feeding back into the process, we've got to then suck all that out of the air as well.
Yeah.
So the job becomes hugely more difficult. It's the biggest positive carbon cycle feedback, to use the jargon, that we know about. And this paper really puts some quite scary numbers on the scale of the problem that we face. And what it does, if nothing else, is kind of double underline the importance of acting quickly. Because if we could, the sooner we can stabilize temperatures up north and hopefully begin to get them to fall, then the smaller the impact of the melting permafrost will be. Taken together with the earlier pretty pictures of the effect of the reduction in snow and ice in the Northern Hemisphere, I have to say it's not a pretty picture, and it doesn't actually help when the next item that we're going to look at, which is a new paper by Kevin Anderson and Alison Bowes, which was published last week, they are basically saying that we have to start cutting our carbon emissions really, really soon, because where we're aiming at the moment virtually guarantees much more than the 2 degrees Celsius that the world is aiming for.
And so what they're saying is that the where we're aiming at the moment is what is guiding climate change policy around the world. Are they talking about the IPCC projections?
Yeah, what they're doing is they're saying, well, look, what happens when you look at where we actually are with our emissions, and they build into their modelling that we're running ahead of IPCC scenarios. So we're looking at a situation where there's the growth in emissions is faster. And then they look at what sort of emissions profiles we might have to achieve if we really wanted a serious chance of staying under or not going far over 2 degrees Celsius. And they find that the kinds of emissions cuts that are required are up to 10% per annum, which most people who have looked at this consider to be virtually economically impossible, or at the very least only feasible if the planet decides that it will do nothing else economically other than try and get carbon out of the atmosphere. There's a very telling line in the paper, which I'll quote. It's from the discussion at the end of the paper, which incidentally is free access, so anybody can download this. It's possibly not bedtime reading, but yeah. it's pretty clear as these things go.
It's from the Royal Society, is that right?
Yeah, it's the Royal Society in UK publishing this.
Okay.
Basically, this sentence struck me really rather forcefully. They said, put bluntly, while the rhetoric of policy is to reduce emissions in line with avoiding dangerous climate change, most policy advice is to accept a high probability of extremely dangerous climate change rather than propose radical and immediate emissions reductions. That's why they call their paper Beyond Dangerous Climate Change, because they also we've talked in the past about this so-called 2-degree guardrail, the target of trying to stay under 2 degrees Celsius, because it has been felt that, you know, that was the rough sort of borderline between stuff that we could cope with and stuff that we couldn't cope with.
Yeah.
What Anderson and Bose also point out is that 2 degrees Celsius does not guarantee a lack of dangerous climate change. It becomes the borderline between dangerous climate change and extremely dangerous climate change. Mm. So they're saying that where we're aiming, we're being ineffectual in terms of our policy at aiming for that target anyway, so we're likely to exceed it. You know, we may end up with 3 to 4 degrees Celsius of warming rather than 2 on current policy settings. But, you know, we're going to get into trouble long before we get to 2 degrees Celsius. Yeah. The emissions cuts that are actually required to get us down under 2 degrees Celsius are much larger than anyone in the policy community internationally are beginning to discuss. Mm. I brought the paper up in a recent post of mine. I made a submission to the government. New Zealand government is asking for feedback on its decision to kind of formally target a 50% reduction in New Zealand's carbon emissions by 2050. They call it their 50 by 50 target.
Yeah.
And the Anderson and Bose paper actually kind of double underlines why a 50 in 50 target is grossly inadequate. You know, internationally, we need to be heading for, as I said, when I discussed heading for 350, we have to be looking at getting rid of our carbon emissions, heading for a zero emissions, and heading below zero emissions. I mean, to get back into safe territory where the permafrost isn't going to melt, we're going to have to get down to perhaps the 350 level, maybe even lower. And that has enormous implications for how our economies are going to be structured in 50 years' time. And whilst perhaps it doesn't seem terribly urgent at the moment, we've put in place the kind of inertia of our energy systems and the emissions that we're making make it incredibly difficult for us to do anything to try and stop it at the moment. And that's before you start talking about people who argue, you know, skeptics arguing that we should do nothing, or farmers saying they don't want to pay a fart tax or anything like that. Yeah, before you get into the politics of it, you know, the science is beginning to get really bloody depressing.
Yeah. And there's more discussion of this up at hot-topic.co.nz. There's a post there by Brian Walker titled The Road to Ruin as well.
Yeah, it's a great post by Brian. I highly recommend a read of that.
Yeah. Our new website is fully up and running, and it's good to see some conversation going on there. It's theclimateshow.com. Feel free to comment on this show or previous shows. Also up at hot-topic.co.nz.
That was New Zealand author Gareth Renowden, along with radio host Glenn Williams, on the new cross-media program, The Climate Show, number 8. I've got a lot of links to the science explained by Gareth, and to the radio show and its host in my Radio EcoShock program blog at ecoshock.info. Find out more by going to theclimateshow.com. Along the way, Gareth hit a really, really important idea. So far, our economy is an engine that grabs fossilized sunlight from underground and releases it into the atmosphere and the sea. To avert utter catastrophe, we have to do just the reverse. Our entire economy may become devoted to drawing down greenhouse gases. Now think about that. Not as a sideline while we keep burning fossil fuels. The new Mission One for survival? Not just the emergency shutdown of fossil fuels, that must happen. Not just the switch to renewables, yes, yes, but much more. A civilization whose technology reduces greenhouse gases before we lose the ice world and a habitable planet. Perhaps you remember the scene in the engine room where the great ship Titanic is heading for that fatal iceberg. The giant engines, burning coal of course, they had to be stopped first before they could be reversed.
On five on it, sir. We can do it.
Yes, sir.
Engines dead slow.
Engines dead slow, sir.
In the movie, that never came in time. In reality, it looks bad, but we don't know yet. Since the captain is drunk on oil money, it is up to us. That's the new message from Bill McKibben of 350.org, from Phil Radford of Greenpeace, and Becky Tarbottom at the Rainforest Action Network. Their newest letter is titled, Seizing Our Power, Why Now is the Time for Creative, Courageous, Nonviolent Action. They write, We worry sometimes that we may have waited too long to get this battle going in earnest. The science is dark and the politics are tough. But we know, from watching our inspiring colleagues around the world who are facing great dangers head-on, that the best time to act is now, end quote. If the unarmed, often poorest people in the Middle East and North Africa can stand up to tanks and fighter jets and the dictators for their freedom, surely we can at least try to save the future climate from disaster. Tweet that. And then act at your legislature, in the streets, in the schools. Wake up your neighborhood. Put down those fossil weapons. Look a child in the face without guilt. I'm Alex Smith. Find out more at our website, ecoshock.org.